This episode of LedgerCast is brought to you by Delta. Go to ledgerstatus.com/delta to learn more about them. You can track your entire cryptocurrency portfolio easily and seamlessly with Delta. It's a truly great app. You can use it on just about any device. Check it out today. Go to ledgerstatus.com/delta. And thank you to Delta for being a LedgerCast partner. Hello and welcome to LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard. We're back after a break. Lots been going on since I last talked to you. I apologize that there has been this break in the podcast. However, I'd like you to go to ledgerstatus.com/learn and check out the program to learn cryptocurrency trading. This is something I'd been teasing for a long time. The first class is already underway. There is going to be a second class onboarding this month for a December startup. So if you want to be involved in that, go to ledgerstatus.com/learn. I'd really appreciate it if you check it out, especially if you want to dig into learning how to trade these markets, whether they're up or down, bullish or bearish. We go over the markets with regular market analysis, but more importantly, for people that don't have the time to dig into all the minutia of learning technical-based trading, I walk you through that, the things that you need to know. I deliver videos and written material each week, and it's about a three-month program to get through it all. I'm proud of it, and I think that it's going to be helpful for many people out there. So go to ledgerstatus.com/learn if you're interested in that, and there's going to be a special Black Friday deal as well. More importantly, Eric Townsend is someone that I just really, really respect, and he's going to join us on the show today. Macro Voices, his podcast, is extremely influential to me, and I think that you'll enjoy his insights, even if you don't agree with him, which you probably don't, about his take on Bitcoin as being what's going to make it out of all of this stuff with digital currency. He wrote a book on this called Beyond Blockchain and the Death of the Dollar, and his theory that nation states are going to be getting into this idea of digital currency. He makes a great case for it, and we talk mostly about that side of things and less about his take on Bitcoin. He had a great debate with Tuur Demeester not too long ago about the merits or lack of merits for Bitcoin as currency. His book also goes into depth on that. I hope you enjoy the interview. Give it a listen. Challenge yourself on your own thinking. You always want to know the other side of the argument, if you will. So I hope you enjoy it. I'm really pleased to have been able to have him on here. And with that, let's get to the show. Hello and welcome to LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard. I'm really excited today because I have a special guest on the show, someone who's written a book called Beyond Blockchain, and it's not really what you would expect because it's not specifically about Bitcoin and crypto. But before we get to there, I just want to introduce you, Eric. Hey, Eric. This is Eric Townsend. He runs a hedge fund, and he is the host of what I think I can safely say is my favorite podcast right now, called Macro Voices. Hey, Eric.
Well, Brian, thanks so much. I'm glad that you're a fan, and I'm really honored to be on your program as well.
Yeah, so you guys release Macro Voices every Thursday evening, and Thursday nights and Friday mornings, I'm usually itching to listen to the show before the Friday morning market open to make sure my own bias in the market is not totally off base, depending on what your own analysis and then your guest analysis ends up being. I mean, it's just incredibly valuable. And I've expressed to my audience on Twitter and some friends that they need to listen to your show. So I hope that people will listen based on this interview, if nothing else. But yeah, it really is incredibly valuable what y'all are putting out there every week. So I appreciate you doing that.
Thanks so much.
So you have a background that I think is pretty unique. I didn't realize until I was reading the introduction to the book that you were part of a software business in your early years and retired at age 33, having sold that business. Can you give us a little bit of your background in terms of how you got into technology and before you got into the finance side of things?
Sure. Well, it started, I grew up in Concord, Massachusetts, which is relevant only because it is the first town in the United States to have a mini computer donated to its junior high school. There were several universities and high schools that had computers in the 1970s. But in 1976, when Digital Equipment Corporation donated a PDP-11 to my junior high school. It was the first junior high school anywhere. So at 11 years old, I started to learn to program computers. And just, I was a computer geek before that term was coined by several years. And I spent most of my high school years sneaking into the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT, which was a really amazing experience. It's probably a book unto itself someday. But they had a program that would allow just about anybody to get a free login account on the computers at the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. It was intended for remote access only, but when I found out what kind of computers they had there, I had to get in on it. So I spent several years growing a beard in high school and trying to look like a graduate student at MIT and blend in, and spending late nights at the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory in Cambridge. And I kind of got my start there and learned all about the internet back when it was still called the ARPANET. And my whole career was in distributed systems, which was really a very new field at the time. At MIT, everything was network-centric, so that's just the way they did things. And I didn't know, as I got involved in industry, that the rest of the world didn't work that way. So I worked on a program called the Integrated Factory Information Network, and I'm like, oh, cool, I'm working on a network. And I look at this stuff, and there's no network there. It's just a bunch of programs running on one computer. And I said, why do you guys call this a network? And they said, well, it's a cool name. And I said, but there's no network. And they're like, what do you mean? And I was just a kid. And I had a really open-minded boss who says, you know, you've been babbling about this. Write me a white paper. If you don't like the way we do things, tell me how you would design it. So I just described how I thought the guys at MIT would have designed this factory shop floor data collection system that they were doing. And they thought it was like miraculous, amazing. And so we started doing... started building distributed applications inside Digital Equipment back in, I guess, 1983 was when we started. And the approach that we pioneered would eventually become known as service-oriented architecture, although it didn't actually get that name until after I had sold my company and retired in 1998. So I spent my whole career working with distributed computing and public-private encryption and all of these technologies that later were used to build cryptocurrencies are things that I worked with in the 80s and 90s, and I knew all about them. I was an expert in those things at the time. So when cryptocurrency kind of took off, everybody I knew was calling me up saying, Eric, you know, you're the perfect guy. You've got the background with distributed systems. You must be like Mr. Crypto Buff. And what I would tell them is, I said, you know, look, I get how it works. It's a brilliant innovation, but my new career is running a hedge fund. I know about the international monetary system. I know who has all the power. And I don't think that, as much as I love the idea, and to be clear, I absolutely love the concept. I'm a libertarian myself. The idea of libertarian activists coining their own money, creating a currency system designed to compete with government-issued money, on a philosophical level, I love it. But as far as thinking that that's going to just proceed to take over the global financial system without any challenge from government, the way so many people in the crypto community were assuming, I just thought these guys are crazy. And the way I still feel about it, and I don't like it, but the way I feel is the crypto community, for the most part, thinks that government is powerless to stop Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies because it's designed as an internet protocol that cannot be regulated. I'm sorry, but that's just nonsense. The government could very easily prohibit the exchange of cryptocurrency for fiat currency. So you can't change your dollars into Bitcoin, and you can't change your Bitcoin into dollars. If you do that...
You touch on that in the book, and you do clarify that it's not that they're going to kill the software, because software, as you and I both know, is not easily squashed, but they can make it to where the average person will have essentially no interest purely through legal means that they have at their disposal, right?
And intimidation and all the other things that government is good at. And I think what the crypto community is doing is to assume that Well, the government's, they haven't shut it down yet. It's been 10 years. So the government's powerless to do anything. I guess I'm old and cynical in my old age. I don't think the government's powerless. I think the government is clueless. If you look at the statements made by central bankers, they clearly don't understand what it is. They really haven't got their heads around it. They're completely confused about the true threat that cryptocurrency poses. Now, right now, law enforcement gets it. The FBI understands that you can use Bitcoin to pay for illegal things, and they don't like that. They're trying to do something about that. But that's nothing. That's peanuts. What the government needs to worry about is not people using Bitcoin for things it was not designed for, such as criminals. They need to worry about Bitcoin being used for what it was designed for, which is to offer a superior alternative to government-issued money. It is superior in many ways. When the government figures that out, they're not going to like the competition. And I think that the crypto community is going to have a rude awakening. And I'm not saying I favor this. I really hope to be proven wrong. But I think that what they're going to find out is, oh, government is very slow to wake up. When they do wake up, they have a heavy hand. And if they issue laws making it illegal to use cryptocurrency, all they have to do is tell the masses, tell the sheeple that it's the tool of terrorism, it's to finance terrorism. That by itself will allow them to gain political support to outlaw crypto. And of course, you can't prevent Bitcoin from continuing to exist on the internet. That would be almost impossible. But if you make it illegal to convert Bitcoins into dollars and dollars into Bitcoin, now you've got something that you can't exchange for fiat currency. And there'll still be a black market for exchanging it. But now it becomes something that you have to engage in criminal activity and risk legal consequences in order to engage in. Most of the people using it will stop using it at that point, and they will effectively outlaw it. So I really hope to be proven wrong, and I think the way that I might be proven wrong is something that most people in the crypto community don't want to hear, which is if smaller governments, Malta's already doing this, if smaller governments say, hey, we really believe in this idea of digital currency being the future. We're going to adopt Bitcoin as our secondary national currency because we see it as the future. Well, now Bitcoin becomes a digital fiat currency because it has the backing of government, at least some government somewhere in the world. It would be things like that, if they happen, that would make it much harder for other governments to completely outlaw it. But where I think we're ultimately headed is government will wake up someday and say, wait, this really is better, and we want to be in charge of it. So I don't think digital currency ever goes away. The future is clear. It is all about digital currency. And I think that people in the crypto community who have this vision of the entire global financial system eventually becoming a digital currency system are exactly right. The thing I think they are underestimating is how many problems government is going to create for them along the way, and how government is going to try to control and be in charge of the process. And it's really a big, threatening, scary story, because once government's in charge, they're going to design the exact opposite of Bitcoin. They're going to design a digital currency which is 100% about tracking and making sure that every single payment, every transaction, every movement of wealth anywhere on earth can be tracked and monitored and controlled by the government. And we're going to get at some point to a showdown where the libertarian activists who invented this technology are going to be saying, hey, cryptocurrency is the way. The government's going to be saying, no, Fedcoin, and it's going to be designed in order to fight terrorism. Mention terrorism if you want to put, just anesthetize the sheeple and get them on your side. In order to protect us from terrorism, we have to outlaw cryptocurrencies and design a new government-issued digital currency, which is the opposite of Bitcoin. It allows them to track and monitor and control everything. And you get to an Orwellian 1984 kind of outcome. That would be an absolutely horrible thing for society. So I think that the digital currency showdown of the next 20 years is going to be one of the most important things to have ever happened to society, ever in history. But it's not going to be as easy as the crypto community thinks of just, oh, government's powerless, we're going to take our vision and roll with it. Government hasn't even woken up to figure out how much of a threat that is to them. They're starting, and we saw just in the last week, the IMF announcement, Christine Lagarde saying the IMF needs to start thinking. And right now, they're only talking about a digital SDR, so it's more of an intra-governmental BIS payment system kind of thing as opposed to an actual currency system that the masses use. I predict that we'll eventually get to the point where what I describe as a new space race. If you think back to the 1960s space race between the Soviet Union and the United States, for more than 100 years before that, science fiction writers had predicted space travel, but it was a joke. It was science fiction. Nobody took it seriously. Little green men from Mars, ray guns, flying saucers. It's all science fiction. Until October 4th, 1957, when the Sputnik satellite orbited the Earth and the U.S. government said, oh, shit. It's not science fiction. It's science reality, and the Russians are ahead of us. And all of a sudden, the highest priority is, what are we going to do in order to catch up and not let them beat us? I think what's coming is governments are going to recognize, wait a minute, these crypto guys invented something that's incredibly powerful that could give government a huge an ability to have much more power over the people. The crypto was designed to take it away. You can use technology in the other direction to design something that does the opposite. Let's do that. And as soon as somebody starts doing that, governments are going to say, wait a minute, Russia and China are doing that? They're ahead of us? Well, we can't let that happen. We've got to be in the lead. And now you have a digital currency space race where governments around the world are in competition with one another to see who is going to dominate this. My central prediction in the book is that eventually the U.S. dollar will be replaced as the world's global reserve currency by a digital currency. But it would be a huge mistake to assume that a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or Ethereum or anything else is going to ascend to that role. I think that cryptocurrency will be competing with the technologically inferior abilities of government, but government has lots of power and authority and guns and handcuffs and military and stuff. It's going to be a really interesting battle, and I think it will probably be a battle more on the stage of public opinion. It will be the government propaganda that says we have to outlaw cryptocurrency in order to fight terrorism. And I hope that the crypto community will come back and say, no, wait a minute, we need to encourage cryptocurrency in order to fight tyranny by government, which is what you guys are talking about, creating this Orwellian currency system that's going to monitor and control everybody's life to an extent that's not reasonable. That's going to be a huge social battle, and we haven't even started to have it yet. I think so many people assume government is powerless. I contend government is simply clueless. And look at the IMF announcement. They're slowly starting to wake up.
Yeah, not just the IMF, but also especially what you mentioned about saying it'll be used for terrorism. That's one of the things that you see from Congress whenever they do congressional hearings with crypto involved, and then some other folks that make statements about it. But what we haven't really seen is firm statements or stances about how, you know, different government organizations are thinking about Bitcoin and crypto. But generally, I do think that you're making a sound argument in terms of government's probably just not woken up to it, which is surprising to some of us in the cryptocurrency community, because you're seeing institutions, financial institutions, starting to pay attention. You know, the banks have trading desks set up, the CME is listing futures, and so you're seeing it starting to hit the establishment from a trading perspective. So it's surprising that the government's not really paying attention to it in terms of a threat to traditional currencies. Something that you discuss in the book, and it kind of just helped me formalize in my head, was just how big of a deal money is once governments realize that Bitcoin is a threat to money systems. And you talk about a space race, but you know, you also give some history about the dollar and the rise of the dollar, and its strength stemming from both World War I and World War II, into the what the dollar is today, which is the last currency people will want. Like if they go to a single safe asset, for the most part, they're going to want it to be the dollar. And you really do think that at the end of the day, some form of digital cash system is what's going to upend the dollar. One of my questions,
and that could be a digital dollar. You know, it could be that the U.S. government recognizes the threat and says, "Holy cow, we've got to create a digital currency version of the dollar in order to maintain our dominance over the global financial system." But the arguments in favor of digital currency are so strong; it's going to take over the whole system someday. The question is, under whose authority and leadership?
And that's where That's where I'm curious, is because do you think that the alternative to a digital dollar is a digital currency backed by a single nation state? But you seem to think that it'll be a combination of states that come together for one currency, right?
Yeah, I think that the options that I see for what becomes the ultimate digital currency system that probably replaces the conventional dollar as the world's global reserve currency. One possibility is the U.S. government wakes up, gets their act together, and builds a central bank-issued, you know, Fed coin, digital currency, that allows them to maintain their stranglehold monopoly. I think that's less likely than most people would assume, not so much because they're incapable of waking up. If they did wake up, the U.S. has the best technology and engineering base anywhere in the world. If the U.S. government got its act together and realized what was at stake, and they tapped the smartest engineers and bankers and smartest guys in the U.S., they could come up with a really kick-ass system. You know, they could do a good job. The thing is, so much of the world is pissed off at U.S. foreign policy. And for a long time, you know, okay, China and Russia are complaining they don't like U.S. policy. Well, China and Russia have been, you know, either enemies or at least adversaries of some kind for 50 or 60 years through the Cold War and everything else. But now we've got Germany coming out publicly this summer, and then the entire European Union. The woman.
This is in regard to the U.S. essentially using the SWIFT system as a political tool, right, for foreign policy.
Right.
And Germany stood up saying that we were essentially abusing SWIFT, right?
And what blew my mind is I thought that guy, I'm trying to remember his name, Haas, I think. He was the German finance minister. I thought he was kind of, you know, speaking out of turn. It was just a personal comment, and that somebody was going to come and say, oh, we didn't really mean it the next week. Because it's Germany, a huge U.S. ally, basically saying the world has to rid itself of excessive U.S. influence over the global financial system. I thought somebody would come and squash him. A month later, the head of foreign policy for the entire European Union stood shoulder to shoulder with the Iranian finance minister at the United Nations in New York City and announced, hey, we're going to create an alternative payment system to bypass SWIFT so that companies in Europe can continue to do legal business with Iran, which is their legal right, which we are going to stand up for our business's legal right, and we're not going to allow ourselves to be bullied by U.S. foreign policy, which is overstepping its authority. Whoa, who would have seen that coming? So we're seeing a change where more and more countries around the world are really getting frustrated with the United States being in charge of everything. Now, I don't think, you know, the obvious thing, if you look at what's going on in this space, you know, People's Bank of China filed more digital currency related patents than anybody else in 2017. And they're supposedly working on a digital version of the RMB, their national currency.
And simultaneously, just to support what your argument was in terms of how the U.S. may eventually respond, China's already done their Bitcoin crackdown. So that's got to be partly due to their understanding of it as a threat to traditional currency systems.
Well, and it's a huge threat for them because there's so much dirty money in China that's trying to get out of the country, and Bitcoin provides an excellent way to achieve that. But what I think is going on is Russia and China have both recognized that digital currency technology is the lever that they could use to attack the dollar's hegemony over the global financial system, except for one little issue, which is they're both smart enough to recognize that their own currencies, the ruble or the yuan, digitizing them is not going to achieve anything. The Chinese currency is a closed currency. There's a lot of widespread criticism of whether or not the accounting is even believable. A lot of people don't trust Chinese data. There's a lot of reasons not to trust the Chinese currency. The ruble just has kind of collapsed against the dollar in the last few years here. In 1998, Russia had to default on its sovereign debt. You know, these are not currencies that are strong enough to just, you know, add digital technology and somehow replace the dollar. But I think those countries are recognizing that digital currency technology is what does have the ability to eventually challenge the dollar's hegemony over the system. So what I describe later on in the book is the possibility that China and Russia might get together and say, look, we can't do this ourselves, but what if we were to help to create an independent digital central bank headquartered in Switzerland? And what it's going to do is create a gold-backed digital currency system. So you've actually got gold bullion backing the digital currency. It's not Bitcoin, which is just digital tokens, but it really is backed by gold. Well, if you did that and it was a gold-backed Russian ruble, nobody would trust it. If you created a new independent international organization and headquartered it in Switzerland for the sake of that country's neutrality, maybe that's starting to have some credibility. Well, if Russia and China are behind it, maybe not. So what they'd have to do is get other people involved. And I think that what they may be considering, and this makes perfect sense to me, is if you were to create that digital currency and say, look, for the seeders, for the people who, the countries that first commit to it, they're going to get a one-time opportunity to contribute gold to this new central bank at a one-to-one for its redemption value. So that gives them the option. They're really not taking any risk. They put in they put in several thousand tons of gold. They get gazillions of new digital currency tokens back, but these are redeemable for gold. So anytime they decide it's not going their way, they can just redeem those currency tokens and take their gold back. But what the new central bank does is it marks up, because there's so much demand for digital currency, so many people correctly recognize that it's the way of the future. What I describe in the book is, let's suppose that the gold backing is about 60 cents U.S. worth of gold behind each digital token. Well, sell it for a dollar, you know, mark it up by about 66% so that you're selling the value of that digital token to the rest of the world. Now what happens if you're Russia and China is, yeah, you've lost control of the system because it's an independent Europe-based central bank, digital central bank. But you got your tokens at a one-to-one for their gold redemption. You can take your gold back at any time. You've got no downside. Yeah, you're giving up a little bit of control, but I think they're smart enough to realize they need to give up that control, because if it's just the digital central bank of Russia and China, the world's not going to trust it. If it's an independent organization and it has really solid digital currency technology behind it, I think the world would trust it. So the question then is, how do you create that organization? Who creates it? Is it something that, you know, you sponsor under the United Nations? Is it some new global entity? Who's in control of it? Who's in charge of it? I don't know exactly how it would play out, but what I foresee is this space race where I don't know who the winner is in the end, but eventually governments around the world figure out, wait a minute, the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the system, its days are numbered anyway because so many people around the world are frustrated with it. What is the obvious replacement? A digital global reserve currency. That means whoever can figure out how to make one work first, and make it work doesn't just mean the technology. It means figuring out the political, the geopolitical issues, all of the national negotiations, everything else, to set it up as an independent digital central bank. Or not. I mean, you could, if you're the United States, you're going to just say it's the Federal Reserve and we're going to create FedCoin. We're going to create the digital dollar. That's going to be the center of the new digital currency system. Right now, the U.S. is behind everybody else in the technology. And I certainly don't mean the private sector U.S. There's lots of smart people in the cryptocurrency world that, you know, a lot of the leadership of cryptocurrency is in the U.S. A lot of the, but in the government, law enforcement's the only one that's even figured it out. And the statements that the Fed has made about digital currency reveal they're completely ignorant about it. Now, if you look at Sergei Glazyev, the father of the de-dollarization campaign, the Russian scholar and advisor to Vladimir Putin, who's been telling other countries to ditch the dollar for the sake of defending against the U.S. abusing its authority as global reserve currency issuer. That guy's going around and giving keynote conferences or keynote speeches at blockchain conferences in Europe. Why is Sergei Glazyev? He's not a computer scientist. He's not the guy from Russia that would be most respected by the techies in that audience. He's the guy who's looking for how Russia is going to get the defeat the dollar on the global stage. He's going to blockchain conferences. Something's going on here. So I think that it's not a question of Russia and China issuing their own currency as digital currency, because it wouldn't be credible. It's Russia and China seeing that digital currency is what's going to control the future and figuring out how they can influence that to their own advantage. And I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. What my message to the cryptocurrency community has been is, look, you guys that are assuming government is powerless, they're not powerless. You're going to face a choice someday where you've got to either beat them or join them. You've got to either keep doing cryptocurrency, damn the torpedoes, we're going to just create something better that's designed by libertarians and takes power away from government. Or at some point, you might conclude government is going to win just because they're government and they've got the guns. And we're better off to try to get involved with what they do as a government-issued digital currency, not because we like that idea, but because at least if we're involved, we keep a little bit of Satoshi's vision and don't have it completely stepped on by George Orwell's version. And that's what I'm scared of. I'm scared of the smartest guys in the crypto community saying, I want nothing to do with this government-issued digital currency system. I'm a crypto, you know, diehard loyalist. I'm not going to have anything to do with the government thing. Then the people that are designing the government system go full Orwell on us, and we end up with something which completely compromises the privacy and not just privacy, but the rights of the citizens of not just the United States, but the whole world.
And that you have every transaction attached to an individual, and you know exactly what they're doing and how they're doing it all the time, because it's all there.
Well, and
it's all in the public record.
That's the scary part, Brian, is if you think about this, it's so easy. I mean, the impressive part about Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is the way that they were able to create this decentralized, pseudonymous system. From an engineering standpoint, it's easier to create a more centralized, not pseudonymous, but every single penny of wealth on Earth, the government knows who's got it, where they got it from, when they got it, under what circumstances they got it, and they can potentially have the ability even to go back and unwind or reverse transactions retroactively. Take your, you know, what if the government, what if the FBI suddenly had the authority in order to fight terrorism to just take anybody's bank account and extinguish that money so the money doesn't exist anymore by invalidating that digital currency token through some administrative interface. Now,
whereas
cryptocurrency is designed to prevent that, but digital currencies could be designed to work the opposite way. And I'm afraid that's coming. And we need the smartest people who really understand this, which is the crypto community. We need them to be effective. That's really my message. And, you know, if you can somehow have cryptocurrency take over the world, that's great. I don't think it's realistic. And when we get to the point where it becomes clear that that's not realistic and government's going to be in charge, I hope the smartest guys in the crypto community recognize, okay, if we can't beat them, we're better off to at least join them so that we can influence this to keep some semblance of sanity in the design of this system. Because government has a pretty bad track record when it comes to respecting the rights of its own citizens.
I'd like to take a break to say thank you to Delta for being our partner for this episode. Go to ledgerstatus.com/delta to learn more about them. You can track your cryptocurrency portfolio, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and many, many other tokens. You can also get an understanding of your portfolio, the percentage of each coin that you have, and get metrics on various things involved. You can get news about your portfolio directly from the projects. They've got so much cool stuff in Delta. They're always adding more. It's a really great app. You can use it on Windows. You can use it on Mac. You can use it on your phone, of course, Android or iOS. It's really, really well done. I hope you check it out. Thank you to Delta for being a LedgerCast partner. Go to ledgercast.com/delta to learn more about it. I'd like to dig in a little bit to your descriptions of money and where crypto is lacking, and basically crypto right now, or Bitcoin, is essentially similar to just the circulating money supply. And you dig in a lot to fractional reserve banking and how a fully equipped and mature money system has layers of what money is and how it operates in that ecosystem. Can you give us an overview of how you think the money system that we see in the real world today could be translated to a digital currency ecosystem?
Well, the first thing to understand is that the fractional reserve banking system, which is the basis of the entire global monetary system, is hundreds of years old, it's antiquated, and it's full of flaws. I quote Henry Ford in one of the chapters there, where I think, doing this from memory, he says, it's well enough that the people of the country have no idea how the monetary system works, because if they did, there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning.
That was actually a really great quote. You did a good job, because I pulled it up as you were giving it. And that's basically because the money that people think is safe in a bank is only safe as long as everyone trusts the system. Because if everyone goes to withdraw that money, the money's not there. And you give a pretty clear and simple explanation of how that works, because, you know, some percentage, 10% or whatever, is what's actually there, and everything else is loaned back and forth between everybody. So you end up creating dollars through that system, meaning that there's more money in the ecosystem than the actual cash on hand.
That's exactly right. And as much as you and I and Henry Ford and lots of people will criticize that system, I think a lot of people in the crypto community make a mistake, because what I've seen a lot is people will say, fractional reserve, man, that's the enemy. That's no good. That sucks. Let's go Bitcoin, rah, rah, rah. Okay, wait a minute. Fractional reserve banking is the mechanism that provides credit. So I'm all for getting rid of fractional reserve banking. I think it is a confidence scheme. But if the crypto community wants to say down with fractional reserve banking, you've got to design an alternative way to provide credit in the economy. Mm-hmm. And what I try to do in the book is say, look, let's not, you know, get into good, bad, or indifferent about whether crypto is you know, good or bad. Let's get into what it would take for this vision that so many people in the crypto community have of, you know, forget about the old system, we're going to take over with digital currency and cryptocurrency. Okay, somebody's got to design a better way that delivers the same benefits to society that fractional reserve banking does, and primarily that means credit. If you get rid of fractional reserve banking, how is anybody going to get a mortgage? Well, there's good answers to that. If you look at the way mortgages have been securitized in the last 20 or 30 years, I can envision a way for investors to buy bonds that create these crypto mortgages. And, you know, you could design that. But the point is, everybody in the crypto community is saying down with fractional reserve. Nobody's proposing an alternative. And what I try to do in the book is to explain the monetary system, explain what fractional reserve banking really is, explain how credit expansion works, explain money supply. One of the things, you know, a lot of people think it's great that Bitcoin has a fixed money supply. The thing is, we're very dependent in terms of how the economy works on a variable money supply, which expands and contracts with economic cycles. Mm-hmm. So you've got to do one of two things. You've either got to provide a digital currency system, which also has a money supply that expands and contracts with economic cycles, or you've got to come up with a whole new different design of how the economy works, which might be a good idea. I'm not saying it isn't. But you can't just ignore that problem and say, yay for Bitcoin. It's fixed at 21 million Bitcoin. That doesn't solve the problem. We have a global monetary system which depends on variable money supplies. We also have a global monetary system, which even though you and I might disagree, the people who are in charge are convinced that it is the mission of government to manage the economy through monetary policy tools.
Right.
So I talk a lot in the book about how ridiculously antiquated those monetary policy tools are. Digital currency technology offers an incredible opportunity to engineer much more effective monetary policy tools,
To put a point to that, right now, essentially, that's done by affecting rates. But then you give the example of not really being able to control, for example, like what the bank does then with that money. Whereas, I guess you're saying digital currency, you can more directly funnel that money to the population.
Yeah, you could completely you have to remember, the way this has evolved is fractional reserve banking was originally born hundreds of years ago by greedy bankers who said, hey, we've figured out a way that we can loan out money so people think they've got money in the bank when in reality we're getting paid interest on their money and it's not really in the bank and safe like they think it is. Eventually, the governments of the world accepted that system for what it is and said, well, if we've got this system, we've got to figure out how to manage it. And they started coming up with monetary policy tools that would indirectly influence rates that banks pay in interest, because they figured that was a way to indirectly affect what interest rates banks charge. And that's a way to indirectly, through, you know, three levels of indirection, influence the growth of the money supply, which is really important to managing the economy. Well, if you're working with digital currency technology, cryptocurrency was designed with a philosophy that says, take all of that power away. Don't let central bankers have any authority over the financial system. Let free market capitalism work without government interference. I love the message, but unfortunately, the people in charge just don't think that way. They are convinced that it's their job to manage the economy through monetary policy tools. Now, if you wanted to give them powerful monetary policy tools, using digital currency technology, you can design a digital currency system that gives them tools and capabilities far beyond their wildest dreams. And it's scary, actually, how far beyond, because you could give them tools that I don't think they should ever have. One of the examples I give in the book, there are people in the U.S. government, I can't believe this is true, but it is, there are people in the Congress who think that it makes sense to put an expiration date on your savings account so that, similar to frequent flyer miles, they expire if you don't spend them. These are people who think that everybody who's got any savings have a responsibility to spend it in order to support the economy. So they're actively promoting reckless financial behavior saving for a rainy day.
There's a reason that companies really like distributing gift cards, because they can put expiration dates and have free money when they expire.
Exactly. So imagine that the government suddenly has the ability to impose expiration dates on your savings. If you don't spend it by a certain date, it's gone. It vanishes. That should never be allowed to exist. But I fear that there are plenty of people in government who think it should exist. The scary part, Brian, is it's really easy from a software engineering standpoint to design a digital currency system that has, I don't want to call it a feature, it has that misfeature of allowing something like that. There's even scarier things that I hesitate to talk about because I don't want to give them any ideas. Yeah. There's lots and lots of things that you could do. If you look at how cool Bitcoin is, you know, they were trying to take power away from government. Software technology is a double-edged sword. For every bit that you can do to take power away, you can use technology to give more power to government. And if you start going in that direction, somebody has got to moderate that and stop it from getting out of control. And it scares me to death, because it can get really scary.
And we've seen that in traditional technology too, with the privacy that we've given to or, you know, private data that we've given to the Facebooks and Googles of the world. So when the federal government pumps money into the economy, our big pool of funds, which we get to do anything we want with because of our privilege of having the reserve currency, is basically selling U.S. treasuries and making those available. And one of the ideas that you talk about in the book is basically upending the U.S. treasury market as one of the components of what a digital proper digital currency system would look like in the real world. Can you give me a little bit of information about how you anticipate something like that working?
Sure. Let's take a quick step back and understand how we get to that. You start with what are the objectives of the government interests, not cryptocurrencies, but government interests that might be trying to design a digital currency system that's government-backed. If you're talking about anybody other than the U.S. government, probably a big part of their goal is to upstage the U.S. dollar and take its global reserve currency status away, because so many people around the world are sick of the artificial amount of power that the U.S. derives from being the world's global reserve currency issuer. So they're thinking like engineers. This is a problem. How do we solve it? Why is it? Question you have to ask yourself, why is the U.S. dollar still the world's global reserve currency 40 years or 45 years after President Nixon defaulted on the Bretton Woods Treaty, which gave it that title to start with, by breaking the gold peg? Well, the answer is that there is no viable alternative to the U.S. Treasury market, to the bond market, in order to provide central bankers with reserve assets. What's a reserve asset? It's basically the savings account for an entire country. It's the money that they need to access in an emergency in order to defend their own currency in a crisis. So it's really, really important that they be able to sell their reserve asset no matter what is happening in terms of a financial crisis starting or what have you, and raise cash that they can use to buy their own currency on the open market in order to prevent it from collapsing. So they want something that they can sell in a crisis no matter what. Nothing compares with U.S. treasuries in terms of meeting that mission. And you're certainly not going to have, you know, Russian or Chinese sovereign debt replace U.S. treasuries. But my contention is, if what you're trying to do is replace the U.S. dollar as reserve currency, the way you have to look at that problem is, all I've got to do is come up with a viable alternative to the U.S. Treasury bond market. If I can come up with that alternative, whatever it's denominated in is going to become the new global reserve currency. So what I do is I create a digital currency system with an integral digital sovereign bond market. And I don't think it would work to just say one country's own sovereign bond market is somehow going to compete with the U.S. Treasury market. But if you use technology superiority to create a digital sovereign bond market, which works better and offers features that are not available in conventional bond markets, and then you start going around to all of the small countries, the emerging market nations around the world, whose debt is dollar denominated. You go to Vietnam and the Philippines and all these smaller countries and say, look, you guys have very tense relations with the U.S. government. The fact that your external debt is all dollar denominated is a liability that's been driving you crazy for decades. We've got a solution. Redenominate your sovereign debt in this new digital currency, in this new digital bond system. Well, first of all, we're talking small countries, a relatively small amount of sovereign debt. So big players like China and Russia, if they're behind the creation of this system, they can get enough capital into it that it would make it possible to redenominate, say, you know, the Philippines or Vietnam's sovereign debt.
To give people, I guess, a little small bit of insight on the importance of that to these smaller countries, usually it's the relationship to the dollar and their own currencies collapsing, which sends them into these, for them, depressionary style cycles. So being able to create more stability and not be so dependent on their own debts and the dollar would be extremely enticing, I guess is what you're saying.
Exactly. So you design a better sovereign bond market, a digital sovereign bond market. And think about the way that Japanese cars were introduced to the U.S. In the beginning, it was the low end of the market. Toyota with the Corolla was just trying to be a cheaper car than any American car you could buy. But they demonstrated their quality, and eventually now we have Lexus, which is made by Toyota. It's the high end, better quality car than most American cars, if not all American cars. So I see the digital sovereign bond market kind of following the same path. You start with little itsy bitsy countries, and then Eastern Europe starts to look at Vietnam and the Philippines and say, wow, ever since they got rid of their dollar denominated external debt and went on this digital system, they're doing so much better. This is great. Now all of a sudden Slovenia and, you know, Eastern Europe wants to be on it. And then France and Germany are looking at it saying, wait a minute, look at what's going on in Eastern Europe. And look at what's happening with the euro and the ECB and all of that falling apart. We'd be better off, and I don't think it's necessarily France and Germany right away, but maybe smaller European countries, you know, maybe Finland or somebody says, hey, this, and you know, look at Sweden, which is already going to a digital currency system, says, hey, we could get, you know, we were already making an investment in digital currency. We could take our sovereign bonds, redenominate them as Eastern Europe is doing, as Vietnam and the Philippines are doing on this new digital currency system and digital sovereign bond market. Now there's more and more market share and there's more market capitalization in this digital sovereign bond market, and it becomes a viable alternative to the U.S. Treasury market, and it also is technologically superior. So it has features that are designed to provide more liquidity. Think about, for people who are familiar with some of the internals of the stock market, years ago it was a very simplistic system, but stock markets have been redesigned to provide, they're called liquidity rebates, so that the providers of liquidity are incented with reduced commissions to provide more liquidity to the marketplace. Now, unfortunately, in the stock market, what that really is a handout to high-frequency traders. But in forgetting about the effect that it's having in the stock market, the point is we're talking about using technology not to create a better stock, but a better stock market that provides more liquidity than would have existed in the old stock market. I contend that you can create a new sovereign bond market, which, because of its technological superiority, offers superior depth and liquidity characteristics to the U.S. Treasury market, not because it has bigger market capitalization, because it's a smarter, better designed market. So I think that it is possible to use technology to design a replacement or a new digital sovereign bond market, which creates a superior alternative for central bank reserve assets. So suddenly there is a better option than the U.S. Treasury bond. Once you do that, all of a sudden, you could see U.S. dollar reserve currency status evaporate overnight, and that would have catastrophic effects, because if all these countries around the world with U.S. dollar-denominated external debt are refinancing, paying off those dollar debts, that's extinguishing U.S. dollar, it's extinguishing global money supply, and it's having a massive effect of repatriating dollars to the United States, and it is basically turning this whole exorbitant privilege phenomenon of the U.S. getting a free ride because of all of the artificial foreign demand for dollars and for U.S. Treasury bonds, it's turning it on its head, and it's putting it into reverse. So now the U.S. is the victim of that, because all of those dollars that were loaned out into the global system are being repaid in order to redenominate that debt in some new digital currency system. Could have catastrophic effects for the U.S. government.
And that goes back to how you were describing fractional reserve banking and the idea that when you issue debt, you're creating money, and when that debt is paid off, you're taking money out of the system. So therefore, our dominance on the global money system would be reduced as that debt is being paid off to the dollar and then being reissued under this new system.
Exactly.
One of the questions that I want to finish up here in a minute, but one of the things that I'm struggling with is how would governance work when you have all these individual countries working together? Like, it reminds me, I mean, obviously the European system is not always clean, and those are generally pretty fairly aligned countries that are working together within the EU. It seems like the governance required in this type of ecosystem would be much more challenging. Have you thought much about the governance side of things and how something like this would be managed?
Yes, I've thought quite a lot about it. The short answer is it scares the hell out of me. The long answer is yes, exactly. I think that if you look at this big picture and you say the people around the world, one thing that a lot of people outside of the U.S. share in common is they would like to see the U.S. dollar not be at the center of the system anymore because they feel the U.S. is abusing that power. If those people rally together around that common goal, what I could see is the creation of a global digital sovereign bank where they say, look, we're going to create a global scale digital currency system that has one central bank behind it that is going to allow any country that wants to join into this currency block. So it works sort of like the euro currency, except instead of being created around these member states, it's created around the central bank first, and then different states can come join it if they want to. The model that I have that I think would make it most effective is that if it were a gold-backed digital currency, now you'd kind of kill two birds with one stone. You've got a lot of people that are waking up in the world of finance finally and saying, boy, this whole fiat money experiment, we don't know exactly when it comes to an end, but history teaches us pretty clearly that when fiat money experiments come to an end, it gets real ugly. So something that's got hard backing behind it would be really good. From a technology standpoint, it's just super clear that digital currency provides so many advantages over conventional currency. It has to be the way of the future. If there is one central entity which is creating a worldwide global digital currency system, unlike a cryptocurrency, it's being designed to appeal to central bankers rather than to take power away from central bankers. It's being designed to appeal to them. And it is backed by gold, and the proposition is, look, the currency tokens are going to be sold at about a 60 to 70% markup above their gold redemption value. But in order to seed this new system, you know, the founder's opportunity, this is for countries, not for individuals, founder's opportunity is put in your gold, you know, a ton at a time, and you will get to exchange that at a one-to-one ratio for its convertibility. You have no risk because if you don't like the way this thing goes, you bring your digital currency tokens back, you redeem them, you take your gold home, and you say, see you later. So you got nothing to lose. But the second that we go live with these things, the currency tokens are going to be selling for about a 70% markup over the value of the gold that you put into the system. We're going to put a 3-year moratorium that you can't just dump those tokens to make a profit, because if we let anybody do that, then it would collapse the currency system. So we're going to, just like founder shares in a company, you know, you're not allowed to sell them until the market stabilizes. But eventually, after some expiration date, they become freely traded. You can do whatever you want with them. And we use that mechanism to create a global scale gold-backed digital currency system that all the governments around the world that want to participate in it can join it. And by putting gold in at the beginning, they get the one-to-one ratio, and the tokens that they get will be worth 70% more than the value of the gold that they put in, with the understanding that they have to sit on them, because if everybody were dumping their tokens at once, it would collapse the currency. You then manage that currency not like a cryptocurrency, but that digital central bank manages it. It's a different mechanism, but it's more like a stable coin in the sense that you don't want it to appreciate by 100-fold in 2 years or whatever happened in the case of Bitcoin. You want it to appreciate very slowly and gradually so that people are rewarded for being in that currency, but central bankers reward value low volatility much more than they value appreciation of the currency. They want it to be a reliable store of value. So what you do is you manage it, and as you're selling more and more of these tokens, raising more and more cash, you're increasing your gold backing. You continue to buy more gold. Now, there's a very real risk here, which is that your own activity basically creates a runaway rally in the price of gold itself, and gold prices go through the roof. So you've got to figure out how to manage that risk. But in general, I think the way this happens is not any one government says, okay, our currency, you know, we're going to take the Russian ruble and make it digital, and now the whole world is going to use the ruble or the digital ruble as their reserve currency. It ain't going to happen. The rest of the world would never buy that. But if you say to the rest of the world, look, we're going to provide some technology leadership. Russia and China have got a big team of engineers working on building some technology here, but we're going to create an independently governed global central bank that all of the nations that participate in it will have an equal say in its governance, and we're going to create something to replace the dollar with a digital global reserve currency. I think they could get a lot of buy-in from a lot of people around the world.
You mentioned comparing this to a space race and how in the early 1900s, everybody thought that was baloney until the 1950s where it became real. I think a lot of people who would be listening to this would think that you're nuts. I think most of my audience doesn't, because they're thinking at least to some degree about what money is and how do we value that, and an age of digital money that they've accepted and appreciate. Part of me thinks this would start to come about with very little fanfare, unlike sending rockets into space. Do you think that this would be the type of thing that is slowly coming out of the woodwork, or do you think it'll be a big bang type of scenario? And if I forced you, do you think this is something that we'll see in 5 years, 10 years, 50 years? Do you have any idea?
It certainly is not 1 or 2 years. This is a long-term story. Off the top of my head, I think it plays out in about 20 years in terms of how long it takes before there is a new global digital reserve currency, which the whole world agrees is the new thing that replaces the dollar.
20 years like a short amount of time to me for replacing the reserve currency.
I think 20 years is how long it would take to accomplish that. I think that within 10 years, it could be clear that we're moving in that direction, but I don't think this is anything that happens overnight. The big question is going to be, you know, there'll be lots of, when you say, is it a big bang or is it, you know, a slower thing? I think there's lots of little big bangs along the way. And one of the big bangs that's going to happen is at some point, central bankers will wake up and recognize the full extent of the threat that cryptocurrency poses, not for its unintended uses of facilitating illegal transactions, but for its intended use of being superior to government-issued money and the risk of the people of the world saying, hey, let's ditch government-issued money and use cryptocurrency instead. Once that actually takes off, I mean, the crypto community predicts the world's going to wake up to that and it's going to take off. I think they're exactly right. That's what's going to happen. What I don't think they're accurately gauging is when that starts to happen and the governments watch it and say, holy shit, we are at risk of losing our control over the entire system, and these cryptocurrency guys could actually take over the world with their cryptocurrencies. They're not going to like that, and they're going to be very heavy-handed. So I think the big bang that comes is, you know, the announcement. I don't know how many people in your audience were alive the day that President Reagan announced his war on drugs. But, you know, through the 70s, drugs were no big deal. Everybody was cool with drugs. All of a sudden, we're at war on drugs. And throughout public school that I was still in at the time and everything else, there was just all of this propaganda about how in order to save humanity, we all had to be behind the war on drugs. There's going to be a war on crypto. It's going to be a government war on crypto when government wakes up and recognizes how much of a threat crypto truly poses to government-issued money. That's going to be a big bang event, but it's not going to mean that suddenly there is a global digital currency system. That's going to take longer. And how it goes down is very unclear. I think if there's an avenue for cryptocurrency to continue to really flourish in the long term, it's going to be by at least partially joining them rather than continuing to try to beat them. Let's suppose you're Ethereum and, you know, you've got a choice of being completely outlawed Or you've got a few governments around the world eyeing you saying, boy, this smart contract integration would be exactly what we need to build that digital sovereign bond market that would give us that competitive advantage we want. We're not sure we love everything about Ethereum, but this would be a really good starting point for us to start building on. Why don't we usurp Ethereum and use that as our the beginning of whatever we're going to build as a government-issued digital currency? I think the way that cryptocurrency continues to flourish is when it eventually gets adopted and co-opted as part of government-sponsored events. And, you know, will the guys, let's use Ethereum as an example, will the people behind Ethereum fight that tooth and nail as, no, we're cryptocurrency guys, we want nothing to do with it? Or will they sell out and say, hey, we can get rich by selling this shit to the government? You know, it remains to be seen. And it's also, you know, we live in an age of open source software and so forth where people can steal things very easily and just take them and run with them, whether they own them or not. So would we get to the point? And I think it's going to be a big choice. I kind of use this analogy that in when I was spending time at MIT in the late 70s, the Vietnam War was over. It was over for several years, but it was still a very recent memory. And what a lot of the guys that I met, the grad students that were graduating, like, boy, you know, I can get this job. I'm really interested in computers and engineering and all this stuff. I could get a job for Honeywell building programmable thermostats, or I could get a job for a defense contractor building guidance systems for satellites and missiles and all this cool stuff. And they were culturally very anti-war people. They didn't want to be part of the defense industry. They were very, very committedly against it. But they were engineers in their heart. They wanted to work on something fascinating. And the stuff that existed in the commercial sector was just not that interesting. All of the cool engineering jobs were working for defense contractors. Most of them ended up working in some kind of weapon system engineering team, because that's where the coolest stuff was. Mm-hmm. And I think what is going to happen for crypto developers, the people who are really the smartest minds behind digital currency technology, is you're going to get to this can't beat 'em, join 'em decision where, okay, what we wanted, Satoshi's vision, it looks like it's not going to happen. Government's going to come down with a heavy hand and stop it. So do I go ahead and take that job with the contractor that's building the digital currency system for the government, which has more Orwellian features as opposed to Satoshi's view of the world, and keep myself involved in the really exciting development of digital currency taking over the world? Or do I stick to my guns and say, I'm a cryptocurrency guy through and through, I'm anti-war, I won't have anything to do with this government activity? There's going to be a lot of people that have to make difficult personal choices. But I think ultimately what will happen is what the government does is, as always, is technologically inferior, but they use the might and power of government to stamp on everybody else and have their way. And I'm afraid that the digital currency system of the future, the long-term future, 20 years plus out, is going to be defined and controlled by governments. And I would love to be proven wrong on that, but I think the people in the crypto community who assume government is powerless to do anything are very badly misinformed. Government is clueless at this point because government is incredibly slow and inefficient. They're finally starting to wake up, and I think what's coming fairly soon in the next 5 years, say, is for government to start really taking a hard line, that presidential address war on drugs moment for cryptocurrency, where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the president of the United States is saying, we've got to do something to get rid of crypto because it threatens our way of life. I'm afraid that's coming. And it's nonsense. It's utter nonsense. But when they figure out how much of a threat crypto really poses to the status quo, they're not going to play nice. And I think people that assume they're powerless are really making a big mistake.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, and it seems near impossible, but at the same time, I could picture the U.S. president saying something like that today. Amongst the many things that politicians say, it wouldn't shock me as much as my head wants to think it would shock me. Your book thoroughly accomplished its mission of freaking me out in terms of the potential implications of a full-on digital currency. I mean, this is something I think most of us in technology would think like makes sense eventually, to displace cash and put it on your device and digitize the whole thing and the whole system. I think that makes a lot of sense. I appreciate the thought that you've put into it, especially from the sense of where crypto came from and where you think it's on its way to. We really didn't get too much of an opportunity to debate about Bitcoin. I don't really think that's super necessary. You actually had a debate about Bitcoin with who was it? Tour. I can't remember his last name right now. I apologize for that.
Tour Demeester, real Demeester, gentleman, super guy.
You. Yeah, so you did a great debate about the merits of Bitcoin, where you make similar arguments, but y'all dig more into the Bitcoin side of things. I really wanted people to hear your take on especially how all this fits into traditional markets and the global political ecosystem, which I just think is fascinating. If people want to read the book, and I think they should, check out macrovoices.com/BB, which is the landing page for the book. You can get it by audiobook or Kindle or the paper copy. And yeah, I really appreciate you being on. And I also would like to reiterate to folks to listen to y'all's podcast. It's something that I just really enjoy. I get asked a lot. It's funny, in a crypto bear market, if you will, I still trade a lot of traditional equities and whatnot. And people are always asking me stuff about traditional markets. Well, one of my primary sources for keeping my ear to the ground on all of the regular markets is Macro Voices. Between your own analysis and the guests that y'all have on are just top notch. And y'all even have a live event coming up. Can you give a URL or something for your live event?
Yeah, it's macrovoices.com/live. We're going to be in Vancouver, BC, Canada, in January 19th. And it's an all-day, 6 speakers, just some of the most popular guests that we've had on the Macro Voices podcast. But start with the podcast. As you say, it's Thursday nights at macrovoices.com. And just to summarize my overall message to the crypto community, it really is this. We really should accept that it is almost a certainty that the entire global financial system will eventually be dominated by digital currency. What we have is not only the opportunity, but the responsibility to do everything we can to make to cause as much of Satoshi's vision, the libertarian view of how things ought to work, to be preserved. My contention is it's not going to come out quite as nice as we want, and we're going to have to make a lot of compromises along the way, because government's going to have some really scary ideas. My message to people is, if you can't beat them completely, join them to the extent that you need to in order to influence the outcome. And that's the way I'm looking at this, is we need to understand that there's going to be a wave of government authoritarian control that comes into this whole digital currency revolution. Let's participate in a way that we make sure our voices continue to be heard.
One final thing, too. This is something that we briefly went back and forth about in email, and I didn't get a chance to ask you. A lot of people here are traders or investors. You do think there are investments and potential trades that will be set up throughout this whole process, I assume, right?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It seems like everybody in the crypto space is obsessed with trading crypto tokens, speculating on the appreciation of the crypto token itself. It seems to me, if you look at where this is really headed long term, look at the companies that are developing distributed ledger technology. Look at the stock plays in terms of who are the innovators that are really going to be building this. And as I look at a lot of the exciting stuff that's going on, I'm surprised that so many people in the crypto community don't seem to have that much of an interest in investing in the stocks of the companies that are doing the most exciting work. They only seem to want to speculate on the crypto tokens themselves. And look, you got to understand, if you have first of all, currencies are volatile to start with. If you're going to invest in speculating on the value of a currency, and it's a currency that is a brand new idea that never existed until 10 years ago, and that faces potentially existential threats from government. So it could be completely outlawed and go to zero, or it could take over the entire global financial system and change everything so it becomes the center of the world. That's huge volatility, huge risk. If you look at something like the stock of a, you know, as a long-term investment, a basket of stocks and a number of different companies that are building distributed ledgers and some of the other technology that's needed in order to create these digital currency systems of the future, that to me seems like a sounder long-term investment than speculating on whether Ethereum or Bitcoin is going to appreciate versus the other one in the next month. I mean, that's a very hard speculation to make.
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of, actually 2017, a lot of the hype cycle, and you don't really get into this in your book or in the stuff that you talk about, but I think people have started to kind of realize that there's more to it than just trading Bitcoin or Ethereum back and forth. But I think a lot of that excitedness was misplaced on these utility tokens and some other things through ICOs, whereas they weren't really getting any security from a company that was building tooling on top of this technology. But yeah, that's a whole interesting side of things. And I just did want to mention that you had said in an email you think that there are opportunities to make money throughout all this in one way or the other.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this digital currency trend, one way or another, is going to be as big as the internet or the personal computer. It's going to be huge. The caution I just want to give to crypto speculators is that doesn't necessarily mean that the price of crypto tokens as measured in dollars keeps going up. It doesn't necessarily mean that. Crypto tokens could be outlawed and go to zero because some heavy-handed government thing is in charge all of a sudden. So, and if that were to happen, whoever the government is buying their distributed ledger technology from, that stock is going to the roof. So think about diversifying, and if you're really interested in digital currency, think about not just speculating in the currency tokens, but maybe investing longer term in some of the companies that are certain to play a role in this.
Yeah, especially as some of those companies do finally end up going the IPO route, and right now we're seeing really just the beginning of that. So many are still in the private equity realm or VC world. Eric, I appreciate you being on so much and spending so much time with our audience. Again, for people that want to check out the book, go to macrovoices.com/BB and check out Macro Voices in general. It's a really great production. I've been enjoying the book. It's a lot of fun, and it's a different outlook than you get from just about any other crypto or blockchain book. It's more about currency systems and their move towards the digital age, which is funny because we're, you know, so many decades into the digital age and money's catching up. So that's really what the book is about, and I encourage everybody to check it out.
Thanks so much, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
All right, Eric, have a good one.
Monuments crumble.